You're listening to The Best of the Sports Company with Sean Fox, an on-demand audio presentation of RedPeachSports.com and ESPN977.com. Now, today's show.
Always fun to talk Saints and NFL with Andrew Hughes from the Saints Nation. What's up, pal? How are you?
I'm good, Sean. Thanks for having me on.
I always appreciate you. Busy week for the Black and Gold. A couple weeks ago, they cleaned house, had to replace five coaches. They've gone scratched off the list. Almost all of them still need one or two more coaches. Let's start with the biggest news, I think. Well, actually, I think two of the three are really significant news. We'll start with the return of Curtis Johnson, the former wide receiver coach when the Saints won the Super Bowl, went to Tulane, was the head coach there, then was in Chicago recently. He is coming back home to New Orleans.
Yeah, you know, Curtis Johnson has a tremendous history with the Saints, you know, from his work with Devery Henderson, Robert Meacham, Lance Moore, of course, the ascension of Marcus Colston. He's got an incredible track record, and certainly when you look at the offense of Sean Payton and the quarterback, Drew Brees, I think it's an easy job for a wide receivers coach to do well in. But nonetheless, I think when you consider the talent that he was given and what he was able to help these players improve, I think he's a tremendous coach. And so, you know, this was – I think every Saints fan saw this one coming. It was one of those things where he was on a one-year deal with the Bears, and everyone expected him to be back on John Fox's staff, and an announcement was made yesterday that – he didn't want to come back because there was another NFL opportunity that came up. And as soon as that news came out, I think everyone knew and expected that Johnson would be coming back to the Saints after the job opening with John Moore going over to the Jets to be their offensive coordinator. And so that spot opened up for him, and it's a homecoming. It's great to see. Like I said, there's a lot of history there. He's from New Orleans. He was most recently the head coach, as you said, of Tulane. A move that just made too much sense.
When I heard that he was not going to be retained in Chicago, or was leaving Chicago, that obviously was the first name that came to mind, was a reunion with the Black and Gold, and that clearly was the case. I was also looking to see what the interest level would be in former Saints great Joe Horn. I say that just because I know a few years ago he was tinkering in the coaching profession. He was a volunteer assistant coach. His son was playing for Northeast Mississippi Community College in lovely Boonville, Mississippi, and I only know that because one of my good friends is the head basketball coach over in Boonville, and he spent some time with Joe Horn. He was interested in getting the profession, and when a lot of guys try to make the transition from player to coach, kind of like Wes Welker, it's usually at the running back position, like as a running back coach or a wide receiver coach.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's certainly, I think, well, look, I mean, Will Smith was supposed to be on the staff until, you know, everything happened with him. And, you know, I've seen Lee Torrance come back and be an assistant last year. And Brian Young, who is a defensive end for the Saints, came back to be on the staff. Aaron Glenn, the cornerback coach, played for Sean Payton. You know, so there's a big list there of former players. Dan Campbell played tight end for the Saints. You know, he's back as an assistant head coach now. So there's a lot of guys that have come back to coach for the Saints. And, you know, specifically those I think that have a good mind, that have good work ethic and know the X's and O's. I mean, Sean Payton's always looking for young, progressive coaches to come to his staff and help. And it kind of – you don't want the gap to be too big. I mean, I think at times what you saw, you know, with Greg McMahon and Joe Vitt and Bill Johnson, those are older coaches. And you know, it's a young man's league. Most guys are 26 or younger, most players. And so to have coaches on your staff that they can relate to and that are maybe going to have more of an impact when they say things, I think that's important to have on your staff. And certainly Horn's someone to keep in mind. I think with Johnson, it's a track record thing. It's an experience thing. To me, it's kind of a no-brainer. Don't forget, as much as Joe Horn loved his time in New Orleans, he did not leave on the greatest of terms. And his final year was when Sean Payton was coach, and they really butted heads a lot. So I know that things are fine now, and that's part of the past. But I'm not so sure that Peyton would necessarily want Horn on his staff. I know that he kind of felt like Horn in that last year was maybe a distraction at times.
Our listeners have heard me say this quite a bit, that I think there are some coaches who are better as position coaches or coordinators, and they're not really good head coaches. And sometimes that's okay. I say that a lot with Will Muschamp, who's now the head coach of South Carolina. I think he's a elite defensive coordinator. I do not think he's a very good head coach. So whenever I see former head coaches on a staff, I tend to get excited, because just because they failed as head coaches doesn't mean they're not going to pan out in other positions. I think that about Curtis Johnson, and I was kind of excited about the Saints adding Jim Tom Sula to the staff. They didn't get that former San Francisco 49er coach, but they did get one in Mike Nolan, and I like the hire to be the next linebacker coach.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, Nolan was a head coach for the 49ers, I believe, from 2005 to 2008. So, you know, he's got 4 years of head coaching experience. And while I think if you look at Nolan's time and tenure with the 49ers, it wasn't the most impressive. You know, I think at the end of the day, you get to be an NFL head coach based on your work up to that point. And certainly he's been a successful coach for a long time in the league. You know, most recently he's kind of been in the radio business, so he's getting back into coaching. So it's going to be interesting to see how he goes, and certainly his track record is impressive. But I think, you know, his job, his number one job, when you look at Mike Nolan and how his success is going to be measured, I think the main gripe that a lot of Saints fans had with Joe Vitt, the former linebacker coach, was his inability to really develop a young player. And I think when you look at the guys that were successful in the Sean Payton era at linebacker, be it Fujita, Scott Shanley, Mark Cimino, Jonathan Vilma, Curtis Lofton, you go up and down the list, Ellerby, those are all guys that have been successful linebackers for the Saints, all veterans, all guys brought up under a different system. No one in the Sean Payton era as a draft pick or as a young player have developed to become a solid starter for the Saints at linebacker. And so that's going to be Mike Nolan's primary responsibility in my eyes, is to coach up a player and make him a contributable part of the defense. Most specifically, Stephon Anthony. I think that is his requisite number one job now, is you've got a guy that's supremely talented, a first-round pick. He's got the size. He's got the speed. Mike Nolan, we need you to transform this player into a competent starter, because right now that pick looks like a bust, and we need that guy to be a player for this defense. So I think Mike Nolan, we'll see how it goes. For me, the measure of his success is intrinsically linked with the performance of Stephon Anthony.
So, hey, Andrew, how are you, bud? Good to talk to you as always. I got a question.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a proposed trial next week on this ownership issue with Tom Benson and the three R's, if you will. Will this thing go to trial? Will it get resolved before then? And does that make people a little nervous around there? What? How are people feeling about that?
You know, it's drug out for so long. I think it's kind of off people's radar a little bit. And, you know, I think it's one of those things where at this point I feel like most people believe that absent a complete reversal of expectations and how things have gone to this point, that the succession is really Gale's, and that, you know, everything else is kind of a formality. And so what that means for the team, you know, I hope that means that they'll stay in New Orleans long term. Business-wise, are they going to be run appropriately? That all remains to be seen. But I think, you know, for now, it's kind of a wait-and-see thing. I don't think there's too much anxiety, simply because right now, you know, Tom Benson, I think his health issues, I mean, certainly a guy of his age, you're not around forever, but I do think his health issues are a little overblown. You know, I think he's been at all the Pelicans games. If you watch any of the Pelicans games, he's always there. He's always in his box watching the games, and, you know, he's active and as involved in the team as ever. So hopefully there's still some longevity there, but I couldn't agree with you more that it would be nice to have some finality and kind of have some resolution on this to know where things stand.
Am I on a?
Go ahead.
Go ahead, Andrew. I was going to say, am I on an island of my own feeling it's only a matter of time? I think it's going to happen this year that the Saints will be the team on Hard Knocks. I know Sean Payton has tried to avoid it like the plague, but I think it's going to happen.
I think so, too. You know, I think the only caveat here is you've got the Chargers moving, and that was a big appeal last year to the NFL to have the Rams on Hard Knocks with, you know, the upheaval of the city and everything. And they're really trying to brew up interest in L.A. and get that market going. And so I could see them maybe do it again with the Chargers to try to garner interest for that team and get some fan support. But otherwise, I think the Saints are a prime candidate, and with all this ownership stuff going on, you wonder how much Tom Benson and kind of the inner workings of ownership would make an appearance in that show.
I'm not buying. I'm asking if you are. Mickey Loomis was interviewed at the Senior Bowl and said, I'm not really that involved with the Pelicans. I don't believe him.
Oh, I do. You know, I think he's really there in a more of an advisor role, and I think he's got a some oversight, and I think as a figurehead in just the Tom Benson brand and organization, he's a guy that likes to have his hands in things and overseeing things to make sure it's run properly. I think at the end of the day, Benson trusts Loomis more than anyone else for his business affairs.
Well, that's clear.
And so I think it's more of a financial and a trust thing to make sure he has his eyes. But I don't sense that Dell Demps is running any personnel or contract, or maybe on a high level with contracts. But I don't really sense that Dell Demps day-to-day has a ton of oversight for Mickey Loomis and that he's getting micromanaged. I mean, I really think he's the GM, and he runs a lot of the decisions. And certainly he was the driving force in the head coaching hire with Alvin Gentry. So I buy it. I mean, I think it probably takes more time away from the Saints than it should. But I completely believe that the Saints are his primary responsibility.
Yes, I would definitely agree with yes. He spends
so.
More time with the Saints.
But I hope so.
I still don't understand. I say it all the time. I don't understand how one person has accrued so much power in with somebody to be a part of not just one but two professional sports franchises. It's mind-blowing.
I'll give you a very quick and simple answer to that. It's trust. It's a trust thing. And I think with Tom Benson specifically, he had a very bad experience with Rick Mueller. And when during the Katrina season, when he really wanted to move the team to San Antonio, I know that he felt very betrayed by Arnie Fielko, a guy that fought very hard to keep the Saints in New Orleans. And so there are two specific instances of Benson feeling like he was burned by his closest allies, people that he trusted. And so trust is a huge thing with Tom Benson, and Mickey Loomis has earned all of it. And so based on that, I think Tom Benson wants Mickey Loomis as involved in as much of his big-time sporting affairs as he can.
Last thing, the Saints at the Senior Bowl last week in Mobile, they kind of have home field advantage by being the closest team to the Senior Bowl, 2 hours away from Mobile. Also rubbed some people the wrong way when they took some players off-site for interviews, and some of the players were late going to other teams' interviews. Other teams were mad about it. But it's not against the rules, and at this case, do what you got to do to get the best players. Coming from a Saints fan, I have no issue with it whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely not. In fact, they asked Loomis about it, and he said, look, if other teams are bothered by it, then that fires me up, and I love it because I'm not breaking any rules. It's not against the rules, and if teams are unhappy about something that I'm doing that's legal, then that tells me that I'm doing my job well. And I couldn't agree more. I think it's well put. Listen, in this business, the margins are so small. We talk about this all the time. How many games are decided by one play in the fourth quarter? How many fortunes of franchises are decided by which guy you pick in the third round when you're down to two players, one that might be a Pro Bowler and one that will never see the field? And at face value, they look like comparable prospects that could be good NFL players. So I think when you look at all that, any way you can get ahead, I think specifically when you get them off site, It's a little less contrived. It's an opportunity to maybe get them to put their guard down a little bit and get some more insight into personality. I love it. I think the Saints have to be creative. I think they're on to something with the way they've drafted the last 2 years, and I think it has been a big improvement. And I'll go back to the Atlanta Falcons, Sean. I've said this. You know, you look at what the Falcons were able to do as an 8-8 team last year, very similar to the Saints, strong on offense, incompetent defensively. And very quickly, they've been able to turn things around by improving their defense through the draft. And you look at the players making plays for them. Vic Beasley, home run draft pick, led the league in sacks. Deion Jones, home run draft pick, making tons of plays for them at the linebacker position. Jaylen Collins, terrific draft pick, a guy that made a huge play against the Packers in the playoffs, forcing and recovering the fumble. Neal, the safety, tremendous pick for them. And so I just listed four players that are either rookies or second-year players that have had a tremendous impact on that defense improving, and it's been enough to get them from 8-8 to a Super Bowl. So when you look at the Saints, a 7-9 team, again, very good offensively, struggling on defense. You hit on a few draft picks here, they help your defense improve, and all of a sudden we're talking about a playoff team, and that's really all it takes. And so if that's what it takes to get an edge in the draft and find some guys that are going to be able to help you defensively, I am 100% all for it.
Andrew, always enjoy the insight, brother. How can folks follow you online?
Thanks. It's thesaintsnation.com is our website, updated daily. We've got lots of great writers that are cranking out great stuff, and you can follow us on Twitter, at SaintsNationBLG. I'm accepting any Falcon hate this week on Twitter and retweeting as much as I get. So any embarrassing moments in Falcons franchise history, send them over and we'll retweet them.
I'm assuming you're picking the Patriots to win.
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I think this is going to be a really good game. I think both teams will score a bit. I think the X factors are definitely in the Patriots' favor. If it comes down to the last 2 minutes, of course, my money's on Tom Brady. If it comes down to X's and O's, you give Bill Belichick 2 weeks to prepare. Of course, my money's on him. But I think one thing to consider here is the Falcons, I believe it's 8 straight games, they've scored a touchdown on their opening drive. And in so many of these games, they've been able to get on this win streak because they go up 17-0. They get a quick score, they get a stop, they go up 10-0. Teams panic, have a turnover, boom, it's 17-0 in the first quarter. And they have replicated that over and over again these last several weeks. And so I think what's critical for the Patriots is how the first quarter is played. If they can settle into a game that's 7-7, 10-10, and kind of weather the storm of Atlanta being hot offensively early, then that's where the X factors come in, and I like the Patriots. But I think the Falcons have a very real chance to win this game, and if they do, they have to start fast, which is how they've been able to get on this win streak.
Andrew, always appreciate you, buddy.
Anytime. Thanks, guys.
Kiefer Price from Warhawk Report joins us here. Talk a little ULM recruiting. What's up, pal?
Hey, just ready for the craziness of tomorrow.
Well, batten down the hatches. So it's been touted, and justifiably so, that ULM, I mean, there were so many people interested in this class that they sold out their signing day and moved it into Fant Ewing Coliseum because this was going to be the number one recruiting class in the Sun Belt Conference. By the time that event takes place tomorrow, is that still going to be the case?
It's going to be cutting it close. Texas State's making a late push. Georgia State's making a late push. And fortunately, ULM lost a couple of recruits over the weekend. So we'll see. It's going to be tight. Top three, that's better than it's been in a long time.
Oh, that's still great progress. Tremendous progress, particularly what after happened last year. I know that ULM lost a couple commitments, as you mentioned, over the weekend. Tell us who they were.
Yeah, Dwayne Fisher, he's a guy who was originally committed to Arkansas last year. He committed, and he committed to ULM, and then this past weekend, he was hesitant on going to visit Arkansas State, decided he was going to go, and I guess their 5 championship trophies won him over. Then Langston Murray, a defensive tackle out of Logan Sport, flipped to New Mexico late last night, and New Mexico, I guess, beat ULM pretty handedly last year,
yes,
put it lightly. That one's a big loss for ULM. would have given them some depth at defensive tackle position. They sorely need it.
Kiefer, another name I want to throw at you. I don't want to butcher his last. Is Jaquale Holmes from Ponchatoula, the running back? Has he also decommitted?
Yeah. No, he's committed. We're just on Rivals trying to get his position changed from running back to athlete because they may not play him at running back. They're going to bounce him around, kind of like Brian Beatty. So we're just trying to get that settled. But he is still committed as of right now.
Okay. Any chance at this point, of course, tomorrow's National Signing Day, and I said, you know, we had a lot of momentum going into it. I think we were at one point ranked, ULM was ranked 87th, 89th, but with the loss of Fisher and Murray, any chance of those kids flipping back? And more importantly, is there a scholarship or two? How many do you think ULM will eventually sign? And is there a surprise or two, maybe locally or anywhere, that could come the Warhawks' way tomorrow?
You know, with these guys flipping so late, I don't see them changing their mind. They changed their mind after going on a visit, so I don't see them flipping back. I think the class was pretty much settled before these two guys flipped. They were at 25 commitments, and that's your allotment. So I don't see anything else coming in. Never know. It's a silly season for a reason. But I think at this point they might look at JUCO ranks and bring in next one or two players to fill in some depth.
If I was to give you maybe the top four, and I hate to say stars of the class, when I ask you to say the top four kids, for those who don't cover recruiting as heavily as you do, who are kind of the top four guys you believe that ULM has in this class who maybe have a chance to make an impact right away?
Yeah, I'll just do high school because those are guys coming up. But Corey Strader, obviously, from Neville, that's a huge get. Cornerback can play immediately. See, Rashad Harding, linebacker from Karen Crow, the guy who played against Neville. They're our younger linebacker as it is, but he's got tremendous skill. Let's see, Zachary Jackson, wide receiver out of Mansfield, Texas. His teammate is actually Duke Carter, so they have that connection going. And C.J. Fletcher, another wide receiver out of Lamar, who had another teammate commit last year. Those are four guys, and one more, Austin Hawley, defensive back, safety out of Gladewater, Texas. I'll give you five. Those five, I think, are really, really strong signings for ULM.
Puffy, what you got for Kiefer? Got anything else?
Kiefer, again, you know, tomorrow's the big day. Is there any position of need that you, like, as you said, there may be a junior college signee or two late. What position do you think would be filled perhaps with one of those one to two to maybe even three scholarships?
I think their biggest need right now is still a defensive tackle. You know, they switched from a three-man front to a four-man front. They switched from guys from defensive end to defensive tackle. So anytime you make that transition, you can be a little light on the inside. Plus, they lost Jaron Johnson last year, who was pretty much their defensive line 2 years ago. So I think, if anything, you know, expect some beef on the inside. Maybe a quarterback, but I still don't think they go quarterback. If anything, I say defensive line.
Kiefer, one thing I've learned through the years, particularly recently, is tomorrow is National Signing Day, but that doesn't mean that this class is finished. Depending on the scholarship limits, they could add another kid through whether high school or JUCO, but more recently, and I've heard there could be some guys with names familiar to the area who follow high school football who went to college elsewhere who are graduate transfers that could still be added here in the near future.
Hey, you know, you never know if someone might show up. A guy who, you know, already signed and committed, Jaquarius Savage from Neville, who talked about last time, a good guy who committed, but it depends on who's able to get eligible. You know, you never know until how grades work out, you know, JUCO, how it's able to work out. So it's kind of one of those wait-and-see kind of things. But more will show out. Depends on if they lose any more people after tomorrow, which, knock on wood, hopefully not.
Kiefer, it's going to be a busy 24 hours for you. Always appreciate the time, my friend. We'll do it next week, kind of get a recap of this class. But for Warhawk fans who want to get ready for signing day, how can they find the website?
All right, that's at warhawkreport.com and at Warhawk Report on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And follow me on Twitter at Kiefer Price. That's K-E-I-F-E-R Price.
Appreciate you, bud.
Yep, have a good one.
We've talked to some of the greatest kickers of all time on this program. We've talked to the great Ray Guy. Last time I checked, they named an award after him. Of course, Saints and that team who plays for Atlanta, great. Morton Anderson. I think this guy deserves to be in the conversation with some of the greatest kickers of all time. Former Kansas City Chief great, the first of many former NFL stars and current NFL stars to join us this week as it's Super Bowl week. Nick Lowry joins us here on the show. Nick, appreciate the time. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm just going to tell you one thing, that one of my favorite memories is kicking in the old down there in the New Orleans Superdome. The opening game of the 85 season, hit a 48-yarder off over the net, a 52-yarder, that's two 52-yarders, a 48-yarder, and a 36-yarder early in the second quarter. And I'm thinking, I'm going to have 10 field goals today. And that was against my friend Morton Anderson. So I appreciate you mentioning that. I think both Morton and I deserve to be in the Hall of Fame, and it's about time that the NFL got over its whatever macho issue with kickers and recognize who are, you know, important contributors to the game.
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was actually one of my questions for you. Do you think that he's got an actual chance to make it in?
Absolutely. Morton, you know, I had a better percentage, and I didn't kick indoors, but Morton, oh my God, he was right behind, and he, you know, played forever. And one of my favorite stories is when he signed with the Chiefs, he goes, "Hey man, would you be willing to rent out your house to me and my wife?" And I said, "Sure." So I'm watching the next game, and he's running out on the field wearing my number 8. I'm going, this guy's living in my house. He's wearing my number. I hope he's not sleeping with my girlfriend too.
Wow.
Nice. Yeah, me too. Yeah.
your story, and I was reading up on it today, it's quite fascinating, all the things that you've done in your life. And speaking of New Orleans, now I'd kind of let you want to kind of go into more detail. There may not have been a Morton Anderson in New Orleans had the Saints probably made the right decision on a kicker.
Yeah, 1979, I outkicked everybody, and there was a tornado, hurricane coming in from Houston, speaking of Houston, and it was really windy, and I just was crushing the ball, and a guy named Russell Erksleben had been injured, so he was their number one pick and was supposed to be the god of kicking. And after that tryout, I go into the shower, take a shower, and Erksleben's just leaving, and he goes, "Hey, man, how do you kick the ball so far and so high?" And I'm thinking, I must be getting better, because this guy is supposed to be the greatest kicker ever. And they would have signed me, but I remember sitting in Dick Nolan's office for an hour. This is like the last week of preseason, and they were able to sign a guy named Gary Apremian, who'd just been cut by the Miami Dolphins and had made his last 15 field goals in a row for the Dolphins the year before. But they had this younger guy, this younger model, you know, named Uwe von Schaman. So they went with the experience. But it would have been a different story if I'd had a chance maybe to start there with New Orleans.
I got a spoiler alert for you. I don't know if you know this, but Erksleben was not a kicking god.
I never even heard of him till today. I had no idea.
That's one of the Saints' many great draft picks. Kevin, what you got for the great Nick Lauer?
Nick, absolute pleasure to talk to you, sir. It's my honor. I have a question for you. Wikipedia has you at 6'4", 215. Was that your playing weight?
My rookie year, and I'm one of the things I'm proudest of is never took steroids ever, although I do know a few people that did during my time. But I was 189 as a freshman, as a rookie. And by the end of my career, I was 215, 217 in the early 90s and probably finished off at about 220.
Yeah, so built like a quarterback. Did you ever find yourself, you know, certain plays, just lowering your helmet and attempting or actually making hits on people just to say, "Hey,
you know
I'm
what?
Not just a kicker."
I was no great tackler, but I will say when Marty Schottenheimer stared me in the face and said, "Kid, you got to be the last line. You got to hit that guy out of bounds." So what I did get pretty good at was working the guy to the sidelines and hitting him out of bounds. But don't ever let somebody think that I could, you know, hit like a Mel Blunt or a Jack Lambert. That was never the case.
So 1,466 points as a Chief, as a kicker for the Chiefs. You're still the all-time leading scorer of Kansas City, right?
Well, you know, in this era of free agency, players don't tend to stay with their teams for very long. So,
right.
But I'm very honored to have broken Stenerud's records. And,
that's awesome.
And, you know, playing with the Chiefs was a tremendous, you know, the highlight of my life, and being able to play under Marty Schottenheimer, who I think is, you know, one of the most underrated coaches of all time. I mean, that last time, 14-2 with San Diego, and one of his defensive backs intercepts Tom Brady, and if he just sits down on the ball instead of returning it, the Chargers probably win, and Marty may still be there. Instead, he fumbles the ball back to the Patriots, and they go back to win, go on to the Super Bowl, and Marty gets fired a week later, and the Chargers have never been the same since.
Never, absolutely. Now, I have one more question
real quick.
Okay, so New England, Kansas City, New York. I mean, that's cold weather central. What was the coldest game you remember?
Oh, man, there were a few. I mean, that AFC Championship game against Buffalo in 94 when a guy named Bruce Smith said hello to Joe Montana, and Joe had such a bad concussion. We had, like, some security guys on either side, so the cameras could not see just how out of it he was. That was one. John Elway's rookie year, which was around 83. Duron Cherry intercepted him four times, and, man, that was just ridiculously cold. The last game of my rookie year in Baltimore, in the old baseball stadium, that was unbelievably cold. One thing I don't miss, guys, is those playoff games where two out of three games, by the way, are determined by the kicking game in the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, most of them are in really cold conditions. So, you know, one thing that they don't quite give maybe enough credit to is the kickers today and in general. You know, there's a lot of pressure on that position. And for the most part, the kickers are pretty darn good.
You're darn right they are.
Nick, your life of a kicker is certainly it can be glamorous. However, it's the one position, I say this all the time, you look at your credentials, you look at your resume, my word, he's one of the best kickers of all time. But it's that one position where you could be great. You could be a franchise's all-time leading scorer. You could go to multiple Pro Bowls. You could be all-pro, but you have a couple bad games and you're out of a job. It took you a bunch of stops along the way before you settled in at Kansas City.
Yeah, you know, and I had to learn how to focus. I had to learn how to, you know, be ready for that unique situation as a kicker, because you don't have 40, 50, 60, 70, 80 plays. You don't have four downs like the quarterback does. You got to get it done on that one thing. And the one thing I knew was I just had to keep putting myself out there long enough to get used to it and to train to be ready. Every single training kick had to have pressure on it. And what I tell kickers today and athletes in general, you know, is that ability to love the preparation is everything. And your ability to focus at any position, the teams that focus, and two of the best, are the Atlanta Falcons and the New England Patriots. They're focused. They don't celebrate. You don't see them go, oh, my God, I made a tackle, and they run, you know, 50 yards down the field. They make the tackle. They may get a little excited for a second, but they keep their focus. That's why I think Atlanta has a shot against these guys, because they're so disciplined. They seem to be able to keep that focus consistently throughout the game.
Nick Lowry, our guest here on the Sports Company, ESPN 97.7. Last thing I got for you before I get you to talk about this game in particular between the Falcons and the Patriots. Everybody says, and it's, you know, you take every kick the same way you do in the first quarter, you do the fourth quarter. Nothing ever changes. But is that easier said than done, saying, you know what, you're going to go out in the middle of the first quarter to kick a field goal instead of, you know what, this is the field goal to end the game, to win or lose the game? You could say you want to approach it the same way, but is it possible to do that?
No, what you've got to do is you've got to train every single kick in practice that way, and that way you can relax a little bit. When you're listening to Mason Crosby talk about that 51-yarder after hitting the 56-yarder, and then they try to ice him, and he hits the first 51-yarder. He's got to do it again. It's a lot like golf that way. You try to not overkick. And if you remember that 51-yarder, it started left outside the upright and came back. And that's because he didn't overkick. So, you know, what you do is you trust your preparation. So your preparation has got to have what I call healthy nervousness, healthy pressure, not neurotic pressure. But you do everything you can to have a game situation, to have visualize the crowd, to know exactly, you know, the situation and the number of, you know, the score of the game. So you have embedded in your cellular memory, your emotional memory, what it feels like. So when you get out there, you've been there before. And I think Morton Anderson was absolutely one of the greatest ever at doing that. And at any position,
You know, that's what I think the great teams do, the great players do, like Teddy Bruschi. I always give him as an example of why New England is so great. Because not only do they do the preparation during the week, but they're so relaxed in the game that they can think situationally. What's going to happen here on third down? This team has this 80% likelihood that they do this on third and long. And being able to think like that, perform like that, it's only because you've had such a commitment to your preparation. And both teams are coached that way by great coaches, and they select players that I think have that kind of discipline too.
I know it's a busy week for you. You're doing a bunch of interviews all over the country. We appreciate your time. I won't let you go without a prediction. What you got this weekend?
Well, before I do, just I want to say I'm working with this company called Victory,
sure.
V-I-K-T-R-E,
absolutely.
Which is the global social media for athletes. And are you there?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay. And it's just a really exciting way to get athletes to get their name out there and their brand out there and to do good things and tell their own stories. So it's V-I-K-T-R-E. Athletes can get connected with fans in a more intimate level. But my prediction is that in the regular season, I wouldn't be surprised if Atlanta would beat the Patriots 6 or 7 out of 10 times. But that experience is so important. So I'm going to say this. My prediction is 27-24 Patriots. If Freeman and Coleman, who were just so incredibly fast and tough, if that incredibly fast, efficient offense of Atlanta can get going, they definitely have a shot. It's going to be a close game because they're so well coached. But in the end, when you've had so much experience like Belichick and like Brady have, and with Brady, that little extra chip on his shoulder because of the whole Deflategate thing, just to finish this story, I got to get the edge to the Patriots.
Nick, we appreciate the heck out of it. We definitely want to do it again. Thanks for your time.
Yes, sir.
Well, I appreciate it, guys, and God bless. And I really appreciate it, and let's do it again.
You got it. Nick Lowry, everybody, one of the greatest kickers of all time.
Thanks for listening to the Best of the Sports Company with Sean Fox. To listen live every weekday, tune in at ESPN977.com or subscribe to the show in iTunes, on Stitcher, or at RedPeachSports.com.